too. All my childhood, I'd had no one. Only Big Kit, as she was known in the cane. I loved her, and I feared her. I was around 5 years old when I angered the quartersman and was sent to live in the brutal hut below the dead palm tree, Kit's hut. On my first evening there, my supper was stolen and my wooden ball cracked. I was struck hard on the side of my head by a man I did not know, so that I staggered and could not hear. Two little girls spat on me. Their ancient grandmother held me down with her talons biting into my arms and cut my handmade sandals from my feet for the leather. That was when I first heard Big Kit's voice. "Not this one," she said softly. That was all. But then some monstrous charge of dark energy, huge, inexorable as a breaker, poured towards us, picked the old woman up by the hair as though she were a boneless scrap of rag, tossing her aside. I stared, terrified. Big Kit just glared down at me with her orange eyes, as if disgusted, and then returned to her stool in the dark corner. But in the morning, I found her squatting beside me in the pale light. She offered her bowl of mash, traced the lines in my palm.
"You will have a great big life, giant," she murmured. "Life of many rivers."
And then she spat in my hand and closed my fist so that the spit ran between my knuckles.
"That is first river right there," she said,
starting to laugh. I adored her. She towered over everyone. Huge. Fierce. Because of her size and because she was a saltwater, a witch in Old Dahomey before being taken, she was feared. She would sow curses into the dirt beds under the huts. Rooks would be found eviscerated, hanging in doorways. For 3 weeks, she forcibly took food from a strong smith's apprentice each morning and night and ate it in front of him, scooping with her fingers from his bowl until some understanding was reached between them. In the smoldering fields, she would glisten as if oiled, tearing up the wretched earth, humming strange songs under her breath, her flesh rippling. Some nights in the huts, she would murmur in her sleep, in the low, thick language of her kingdom, and cry out. No one ever spoke of that. And in the fields the next day, she would be all scorched fury, like a blunt axe, wrecking as much as she reaped. Her true name, she once told me, whispering, was Nawi. She had had 3 sons. She had had 1 son. She had had no sons, not even a daughter. Her stories changed with the moon. I remember how, some days, at sunrise, she would sprinkle a handful of dirt over her blade and murmur some incantation, her voice husky, as though overcome with emotion. I loved that voice, its rough music. She would suck air through her teeth and squint up her eyes and begin,
"When I was royal guard at Dahomey," or "after I crushed the antelope with my hands like this,"
and I would stop whatever task was at hand and stand listening in wonder. For she was a marvel, witness to a world I could not imagine, beyond the reach of the huts and the vicious fields of faith. Faith itself darkened under our new master. In the 2nd week, he dismissed the old overseers. In their place arrived rough men from the docks, tattooed, red-faced, grimacing at the heat. These were ex-soldiers or old slavers or just island poor, with their papers crushed into a pocket and the sunken eyes of devils. Then the maimings began. What use could we be, injured so? I saw men limp into the fields, blood streaming down their legs. I saw women with blood-soaked bandages over their ears. Edward had his tongue cut out for back talk. Elizabeth was forced to eat from a full chamber pot for not cleaning the previous days thoroughly. James tried to run away, and to make an example of him, the master had an overseer burn him alive as we watched. Afterwards, in the embers of his pyre, an iron was heated, and we filed past the charred horror of him, one by one, and were branded a 2nd time. James's was the first of the new killings. Other killings followed. Sick men were whipped to shreds or hanged above the fields or shot. I was still a boy and cried at night, but with each new death, Big Kid only grunted in grim satisfaction, her orange eyes narrowed and fierce. Death was a door. I think that is what she wished me to understand. She did not fear it. She was of an ancient faith rooted in high river lands of Africa, and in that faith, the dead were reborn, whole, back in their homelands, to walk again, free. That was the idea that had come to her with the man in white, like a thread of poison poured into a well. One night, she told me of her intention. She said we would do it quickly. It would not hurt.
"Do we frighten you?"
she whispered, where we lay in the hut.
"To be dying?"
"Not if it don't frighten you,"
I said bravely. I could feel her arm draped protectively over me in the dark. She grunted, a long, dark rumble in her chest. "If you did, you wake up again in your homeland. You wake up free."
I made a little shrug of one shoulder at that, and she felt it, and turned my chin with her fingers.
"What is it now?"
she asked.
"You don't believe?"
I did not want to tell her. I feared she would be angry. But then I whispered,
"I don't have a homeland, Kid. My homeland here. So I wake up here again? A slave? Except you won't be here?"
"You come with me to the homie," she murmured firmly. "That's how it works."
"Did you ever see them? The dead waked up? When you went to homie?"
"I saw them," she whispered. "We all saw them. We knew what they were."
"And they were happy?"
"They were free."
I could feel the day's exhaustion descending on me.
"What it like, Kid? Free?"
I felt her shift in the dirt, and then she was gathering me in close, her hot breath at my ear.
"Oh, child, it's like nothing in this world. When you're free, you can do anything."
"You go wherever it is you wanting?"
"You go wherever it is you wanting. You wake up anytime you wanting. When you're free," she whispered. "Someone ask you a question, you ain't got to answer. You ain't got to finish no job you don't want to finish. You just leave it."
I closed my heavy eyes, wondering,
"Is really so?"
She kissed my hair just behind my ear.
"Mm-hmm. You just sit down this shovel, and you go."
Why then did she delay? The days passed. Faith grew harsher, more brutal. Still, she did not kill us. Some presentiment, some warning perhaps, stayed her hand. One evening, she led me out into her little vegetable garden, where we were alone. I saw the sharp, rusted blade of a hoe in her hands and started to tremble. But she only wished to show me the little carrots beginning to sprout. Another night, she woke me and led me silently out into the darkness, through the long grasses to the dead palm tree. But this too was only to instruct me not to speak of our intentions.
"If any hear of it, child, we be separated too,"
she hissed. I did not understand why we waited. I wanted to see her homeland, I told her. I wanted to walk into homie with her, free.
"But it must be done right, child,"
she whispered to me.
"Under a right moon, with right words. The gods cannot be summoned otherwise."
But then the other suicides began. Cosimo cut his own throat with an axe. Adam punctured his wrists using a nail stolen from the smithy. Both were found bled out in the grass behind the huts, one after the other, in the mornings. They were old saltwaters, like Kit, believers that they would be reincarnated in their ancestral lands, but when young William, who had been born on the plantation, hanged himself in the laundry, Erasmus Wilde himself came out among us. He walked slowly over the lawns in his dazzling white clothes, an overseer trailing a few steps behind. The overseer wore a tattered straw hat and was pushing a wheelbarrow. The cradle of the barrow held a wooden post, a tangle of gray sacking. They crossed the grass in the harsh sun, pausing just at the edge of the cane where we had been assembled. In the hot, bright air, the new master studied us. I could see the flesh on his face and hands, waxen and bloodless. His lips were pink, his eyes a very piercing blue. Slowly he walked the line of our bodies, staring at each of us in turn. I could hear Big Kit breathing roughly above me, and I understood she too was frightened. When the master looked at me, I felt the scorch of his gaze and lowered my eyes at once, shivering. The air was stagnant, redolent of sweat. Then the man in white gestured behind him to the overseer. That man twisted the handles of the barrow, dumping its load in the dirt. A murmur passed through us, like a wind. Sprawled there in the dirt in a heap of gray clothes was William's corpse. His face was a rictus of pain, his eyes bulging, his tongue black and protruding. Some days had passed since his death, and strange things were happening already to his body. He looked corpulent, bloated. His skin had become mottled and spongy. A slow horror filled me. The master's voice, when at last he called out to us, was calm, dry, bored.
"What you see here, this nigger, killed himself," Erasmus Wilde said. "He was my slave, and he has killed himself. He is therefore stolen from me. He is a thief."
He paused, folded his hands at the small of his back.
"I understand that some of you believe that you will be reborn in your homelands when you die."
He looked as though he might say more, but then he fell silent, and, turning abruptly, gestured to the overseer at the barrow. That man crouched over the body with a large, curved skinner's knife. He reached around and cupped his calloused palm under William's chin and began to saw. We heard the terrible wet flesh tearing, the crunch of the bones, saw the weird, lifeless sag of William's body as the head came away. The overseer stood and raised the severed head in both hands. Then he walked back to the barrow and took out the long wooden post. Hammering it into the dry earth, he drove William's head onto the sharp end.
"No man can be reborn without his head," the master called out. "I will do this to each and every new suicide. Mark me. None of you will ever see your countries again if you continue to kill yourselves. Let your deaths come naturally."
I stared up at Kit. She was peering at William's head on its spike, the bulge of its softening flesh in the sun, and there was something in her face I had not seen in her before. Despair.